A.C. Grayling is Master of the New College of the Humanities in London and a Supernumerary Fellow of St. Anne's College, Oxford. He's a philosopher who's written and edited more than 30 books, including The Age of Genius, Democracy and Its Crisis, The Good Book, A Humanist Bible, and last time with us, The History of Philosophy. The thing is that the last time wasn't so long ago, towards the end of 2019, I think. He's prolific. He writes countless newspaper and magazine columns and is heavily involved with the British Humanist Association. The latest book is The Frontiers of Knowledge, incorporating the history of science and thought, life generally, the human mind, and it looks towards the future and what we can glimpse in it. Professor Anthony Grayling, good morning.
Good morning, Jim. How nice to hear you.
It's not so long that we last talked, and I'm curious, where did you find the time for this new exploration and compendium of knowledge of yours?
Well, I'm addicted to the process of writing, so I'm always busy scribbling away. And although we've had a really tragic situation here in the UK with COVID, and I grieve for the tens of thousands of people who, families who have lost, those they care about, I'm afraid it's an ill wind that blows nobody any good, because lockdown has suited me. I've got a lot of writing done in the process. My troglodytic nature has somewhat benefited from it.
So troglodytic is an adjective. Thank you. I never knew that. You set out to write The Frontiers of Knowledge specifically. Why, though, please?
Well, for one thing, I'm fascinated by the fact that so recently, very, very recently, we've had this huge explosion of knowledge. And yet what this enormous explosion of knowledge, which, by the way, has been fantastic in its applications via technology, not least, for example, in the very medium that we're using to talk to one another right now, or in clinical applications in neurology and so forth. But despite that, what this great explosion of knowledge has taught us is how little we know. Less than 5% of the content of the mass density of the universe is accessible to us. That's what we've learned from this huge development of scientific knowledge. We only know 5% of the universe.
Yes, you say, or I'm paraphrasing, that we thought science would not only unlock the doors of mystery, but arrive at some kind of final frontier of knowledge where ignorance would be dispelled. But there's been a dramatic reversal. What do you mean?
Well, it used to be thought, that the more we learned, the more we discovered, the less ignorant we were. On the contrary, the more we know, the more we know we don't know. The great, great universe of the yet to be known, the yet to be discovered, is even larger than we thought it was. And this has very interesting and, I think, important consequences, because it implies things about the nature of inquiry and about the nature of education. So if I go back to that point about the belief that we originally held, that we were bit by bit creeping up on certainty and on truth, that the model of knowledge that we had was that we were, miners digging and getting closer and closer to the seam of gold. Imagine that you're on an island which is growing in the midst of the ocean. Well, as your island grows, that's the growth of our knowledge, so your shoreline gets longer and longer. That's the frontier of knowledge. That means that the landscapes, the terrain, the oceans of ignorance beyond the shoreline get bigger and bigger.
There appears to be the odd tsunami. You've said that, it's a nice analogy, by the way, but you've said that populism is the artifact of demagoguery, and that's a tradition that goes back a very long way. And you have said the modern mind is newly under threat from the old mind, for example, terrorism and religious fundamentalism. And your solution is education. So are you now implying that education may not have the lifting power in order to enable us to be confident at this new frontier?
Well, I believe that it does, but I think that we're making a mistake with the way that we educate. We have this cliche. Everybody talks about critical thinking, and it's become such a cliche that people don't take it seriously. But actually, it is really, really crucial. This is because we now have all this new knowledge. We have the internet, we have access at the touch of a button to all sorts of data, information, but we know that data is not knowledge until you organize it, until you find the patterns and the framework to put all that data into the right kind of relationship with itself, then that's knowledge. But not even knowledge is the last step, because the last step is understanding, is insight, is knowing what that knowledge is worth, how to use it, how to apply it, which bits really matter, and what it tells us about what we need to discover next. And so that the focus of education should be on the ability to evaluate information, to be very critical and skeptical in the right kind of healthy way about it, and to know how to make use of the resources of inquiry. And nowadays, instead of educating people to be good thinkers, we train people to occupy a silo, to have a specialism. Instead of giving them that general literacy around their specialism, which enables them to put it into context and make good sense of it.
I mean, COVID evinces that, doesn't it? I mean, the epidemiologists and the public health experts have, by and large, turned out to be completely right. But a significant number of contrarians don't find that sufficient. Same with climate change, with the argument that even scientific consensus isn't enough and there are still notable abstainers. We actually have a lot of silos and not entirely discourse that walks between them sometimes.
Well, you raise a very good example here, actually, because, you know, if the general population were literate in an understanding of sort of medical science, they don't have to be experts in it, but to have a good, intelligent grasp of what's happening there, they would be able to make sense of what is said by the epidemiologists and the virologists. They'd be able to put it in some kind of context. You know, we frightened ourselves by saying, oh, well, a little knowledge is a dangerous thing, and, you know, to just have a very superficial and sketchy understanding of something is very bad. And that frightens people off making the effort to have what I describe as an intelligent and responsible grasp of things. Take science, for example. I mean, there are so many first-rate scientists, Nobel Prize-winning physicists and cosmologists, who write for a general public about their area of interest. There's no excuse, actually, for anybody not to know what's happening in the sciences, or not to know what's happening in historical research, or not to have an overview of developments in medicine. And a really thoughtful and informed public would be one that took a pride in having this kind of intelligent grasp. And that's the thing that I need, you know, to stress here, that our education ought to be encouraging people to be people like that.
Because we have discourses and media which are fairly standard. I mean, with climate change, yes, it's certainly happening, but the agreed discourse may ignore the possibility, which is interesting, even if it's not right, that the warming may induce an ice age or similar in northern latitudes because of the physical paradox of the way those conveyor belt currents work in the deep ocean. So the crisis is real. But let's not ignore what branches of science are suggesting, as well as the big scientific picture, because science contains multitudes, and we aren't hearing those multitudes, are we?
That's true enough. Now, again, you raise a very interesting point there, because, you know, we have to advance rather as an army does, I suppose, on multiple fronts here. The absolutely central thing is that in the old-fashioned definition of knowledge as completely indubitable truth, in place of that, what we have got is, as you mentioned earlier, the idea of rational belief. And rational is the important word here, because the first part of that word is ratio, which means proportion. And that means that the belief in question is proportioned to the evidence that we have and the reasons we can offer. And that is the paradigm of rational belief. This is why it's not rational to believe that there are fairies at the bottom of your garden, because the evidence in support is so poor. Once you've got that idea in mind, the idea of rational belief really powerfully supported, you recognize then that these beliefs are nevertheless defeasible. Another great word there, meaning that new evidence could refute it or make us adjust it or change it or look for a new theory. And it's that openness, that preparedness to revise and to think again and to be led by the evidence, not by what you want to be true, which is distinctive of the scientific outlook. This open-minded, open-ended, highly rational, highly test-dependent way of approaching knowledge has become functionally dominant, has become incredibly powerful in its applications to our world, and paradoxically has shown us how little we know.
It's a bit like that wise old character in the movie, you know, who always said, you know, the more I know, the less I know. You say, you said earlier, we have access to only about 5% of physical reality. That's if we accept the Big Bang theory.
Yeah, except the Big Bang theory, but also, you know, the reason for thinking that there is dark matter is it's called dark energy, and that together they make up about 95% of the mass density of the universe, is based on observation. So you look at the galaxies and galaxy clusters, you see them behaving according to gravitational law, but not on the basis of the visible stuff that's there. So there has to be invisible stuff there to explain that, unless the principle of gravity is wrong. But then the principle of gravity works wonderfully well. Although even there, the fact that it works well is not a guarantee of its truth. In the book, you may remember I list a number of things that we are tempted by. Yes. And we are tempted by thinking that if something works, it must be true. And that's not always the case, of course. But before chucking out a theory that has got us to the moon and to Mars, and generally speaking, advises us not to jump off high buildings unless we mean to, we are going to hang on to gravity and look for some other reason. Similarly with dark energy. I mean, there's an extraordinary observation that halfway through the life of the universe so far, that is from the Big Bang as we hypothesize it, the universe has suddenly started to speed up in its expansion. The only thing I can explain that is that there is some kind of energy which is pushing the universe apart, greater than the power of gravity, which we're pulling it together. But we don't know what that is. So these are marvelous mysteries.
Professor Anthony Grayling is talking to us. The Frontiers of Knowledge is his new book. You know, I came across Alexander Pope towards the end of your book, to my slight surprise. And I remember from my school days, he said, this is about the only line of his I remember, "Presume not God to scan. The proper study of mankind is man." And I suppose I recall it for a reason. And so the essential question, do we get anywhere with musing upon the nature of gravity or wondering about dark matter? Will we ever solve the impenetrabilities of string theory? Will we ever know if the many worlds theory is correct? You know, it can seem to us like insane energies when really all most of us want is a secure life and raising our children well. You know what I mean?
Well, in the matter of quoting poets, I also quote the French poet Paul Valéry, who said a marvellous thing. He said, "A difficulty is a light. If you try to tackle a difficulty, it's very illuminating. You learn a huge amount." But then he said, "An insurmountable difficulty is the sun." Because an insurmountable difficulty, when you really have a go at it and you try to make sense of it, you try to solve that problem, you learn even more. Wonderfully illuminating. So all the challenges that we have, even the very, very hardest things that we try to understand, you may remember John F. Kennedy had these marvelous speech writers, and when he announced that they were going to put a man on the moon before the end of the 1960s, he said, "We're going to try to do this not because it's easy, but because it's hard. And when you do hard things, you grow." So this attempt to make sense of our universe around us and to tackle these incredibly difficult questions is precisely what it is that makes us as a species develop.
He had the best speechwriters, didn't he, JFK? You enunciate problems with what we know early on, and I can't go through all the problems, but the pinhole problem, the metaphor problem, the map problem, the pinhole problem to start, please, if you wouldn't mind.
Certainly. So at the scale we find ourselves at, a little bit over halfway between the very smallest units of measurement, the Planck units, you know, Planck length, Planck time, and the size of the universe as a whole. If you put us on a scale, we're a bit over halfway in between. And this may be because that's as far as we can see, down to the small and up to the large. Maybe that things are very, very much smaller at the small end and very, very much larger at the large end. But our reach is limited. And it's limited because we are finite. Our powers of reason, our powers of perception are finite. They are tuned just to that little bit of reality that we have access to. And so trying to understand the universe is a bit like peering through a little pinhole in the fabric of reality. And pushing through that pinhole our instruments, the instruments well, like microscopes and oscilloscopes and telescopes, but also the instrument of mathematics, to try to make some sense of what's beyond the pinhole. We know that what we perceive around us in the way of sticks and stones and buses and motor cars and so forth is actually a virtual reality created mainly at the back of our heads. And what we're seeing is a picture created by the electrochemical activity in our brains. We're not looking out of windows, our eyes, at a world out there which is as it seems to be. And yet, we use this virtual reality construct in our skulls as the test of what we think we can reach through the pinhole from our very, very limited, constrained, restricted place in the scheme of things, trying to understand what the heck is out there and around us.
We take our eyesight for granted, of course, most of us, but you say we shouldn't. It's a matter of utmost wonder how vision occurs. It is when you describe it. All right. And, for example, you mentioned the hammer problem, which is summed up, if your only tool is a hammer, everything looks like a nail. And the lovely lamplight problem, you look for your lost keys under the street lamp because it's the only place where you might be able to see them. They're quite delightful. What about the closure problem? Because this affects politics especially, you would think.
Oh, yeah. I'm afraid this is a very beguiling one. So the closure problem is that we humans, we love to have things explained and sort of neatly tied off and even signed off. So we like stories. We like beginning, middle and end. We like everything to be boxed up. And so we jump to conclusions. We want to get closure. We want to get an explanation. And I sometimes say to people, well, you know, all the mythologies and religions and legends and what have you, all of them have this very neat narrative structure. And they all provide us with a kind of sign-off at the end. And all of them can be told or explained in less than half an hour. The problem with physics is it takes a bit more than half an hour to understand what's going on there, and there's no closure. But we sometimes jump to it, and indeed we're a bit inclined to do that with the current state of brain science, which is amazing. I mean, amazing things are being done in brain science. But the harshest skeptic about what's happening in brain science would say that all this very, very high-tech equipment, functional magnetic resonance imaging and so on, is just a very expensive form of phrenology, because what you're looking at are large structures in the brain, rather as the phrenologist looked at bumps on your skull, and it's the microstructure of the brain, those 86 billion neurons and their interconnections where the real stuff is going on. So we mustn't yield to the closure temptation. We must not jump to conclusions about what's happening there.
Yes, we assign, don't we, an awful lot to areas of the brain which we then kind of view as machinery, in a sense, and it's much more complex and more holistic.
Yeah, absolutely right. Quite a lot of even of the clinical applications of what's been discovered, and they're tremendous. Being able to locate the sources of epileptic seizures and those structures in the brain that go wrong with Parkinson's, all those things, I think that's incredibly helpful. But if you talk to a brain scientist, a neurologist, or a neuroscientist, they will tell you that what we get from these scans of the brain, even in real time, that fMRI scanning, of subjects being challenged with tasks and memories and emotions and so on, are correlations, not causal connections, but correlations. So far, what we've got are some, relatively speaking, large-scale sense of the structures in the brain that activate, but we've got a long, long way to go, really, to understand what's happening there.
Speaking of that, there's also, though it's not on your initial list of challenges and problems, it's mentioned later in the book, the measurement problem with quantum theory that we have.
Oh, yeah. Well, this is famously the business about how you interpret quantum theory. This is one of the big puzzles, because quantum reality seems so strange. I expect most people have heard about Schrödinger's cat. There is this poor animal in the box. It's both alive and dead, or neither alive nor dead, or it will be one or the other, depending upon if an observation is made or if the wave function collapses because of interaction with some other particle, something like that. And so this is the great problem about how we interpret quantum theory. And one of the difficulties there is that with trying to get an interpretation of quantum theory seems to be at least part of the story of unifying quantum theory with relativity, at the moment they appear to be incompatible, unless one or other of the proposals, like, for example, string theory or quantum loop gravity or some theory like that, can reduce the big gap between the theory of the small scale, which is quantum theory, theory of the large scale, which is relativity.
You talk about the technology that came before science, and I can't start to even begin to do this big section of the book justice. But for those who aren't scholars of history, ingenuity of a tremendous sort and inventiveness was present even 4,000 years ago, wasn't it? It was prodigious. We could tell the time in 2300 BC.
Yeah, and indeed even earlier than that, if you go back hundreds of thousands of years to the very first tool users among our ancestors, dealing with, you know, problems of survival, staying alive, getting food, keeping warm, defending ourselves against predators. And for, well, literally hundreds of thousands of years, we've been amazingly inventive. And then just in this last 100 years or so, with this huge explosion, exponential growth in our knowledge, is knowledge what? Which explains the knowledge how. You know, I point out in the book that it's alleged of the French that they say, because as you know, they're a very philosophical nation, they say, oh, well, it works in practice, but does it work in theory? Because that's the really interesting thing. But, you know, for humankind has always had lots of things working in practice. But very recently, we've begun to think about what explains it. And that is where this great explosion of knowledge has come from, looking for the explanations.
But even way back, they knew, we've maybe always known, that there are mechanisms, you say, that lie beneath the surface of things. And the more we know now, the more mechanisms, if you like, we seem to be discovering, Anthony.
That's right. Yes, yes, absolutely. This is why I think, by the way, that the origins of religion lie in our ancestors' very earliest efforts to try to guess what kind of mechanisms might lie behind nature. So I pick up a stone, I throw it in the pond, it makes a splash. I did that. I was the causal origin of that. So if there's thunder, if there's lightning, if there's rain, if there's wind, surely there's some kind of agency behind it. And out of that might come, you know, belief in deities and demons and so forth. But the effort to interact with those agencies, to influence them, to get them on your side or to get them to bring the rain in a drought and so forth by praying to them or making sacrifices to them, that would explain a lot as well. So that effort to have answers to the question, what explains this? That is something which is very distinctive of humanity also.
By the by, you know, you're a humanist, but I remember Tolkien persuaded Lewis, C.S. Lewis, that our metaphors, the metaphors in the great human stories, not at that what caused the lightning level, but the great human yarns, indicated the presence of a god because they must contain core kernels of truth. If you look at the macro, you can find religion as well.
That's true. You of course, ally the remark that Lewis made there with the metaphor problem itself. Taking our metaphors too seriously, I suppose, would be one response there. The other thing to say about it is that our belief, the ancestors' belief, in the presence of something, some mechanism, some explanation for what goes on behind the scenes in nature, is something that bit by bit, and very, very recently, we've really begun to discern. So we've discovered some of these mechanisms. Indeed, we've even achieved some mastery over them to the extent that we're able to apply them by technology.
There are so many people mentioned in this book, as one can imagine, and there are Francis Bacon and René Descartes who set out to separate sense from nonsense regarding what we believe. But there are also the people like Isaac Newton, who fascinatingly, you tell us, spent more time on alchemy, numerology, and efforts to crack what he thought was a secret code in the Bible than on the science that made him famous.
That's right, yeah. After the Reformation, and when many, in fact, perhaps you could say about half of the states of Europe had become Protestant, the churches in the Protestant parts of Europe didn't have the power that the church did in the Catholic parts of Europe to control what people were thinking and what they could publish, what they could say. And so in those parts of Europe, there was a kind of efflorescence of interest, not as you would expect, in serious science, but in magic, in Kabbalah, in Hermeticism, in astrology, that there were still some things to be learned from alchemy, still some things to be learned from astrology, maybe, that could give you a shortcut to knowledge or a shortcut to control over aspects of reality. Pretty well by the 18th century Enlightenment, those hopes, and they were nourished by Newton, as you say, have more or less gone. They're now part of the archaeology of human thought.
Yeah, it's fascinating knowing that. And in your history section, which has great sweep, you introduce us to characters we may never have heard of. We all know about Newton, but we mightn't have known that about him. But Sargon, the ruler of the world, he thought he was 5,000 years ago, and his great lost city of Akkad. Where would Akkad or Akkad be exactly?
In Mesopotamia, in the land of the two rivers, the Euphrates and the Tigris. And I mean, this is pretty extraordinary, really, because I think to myself with wonder, with amazement, I think to myself the following, that my grandfather, when he was at school, would have known nothing whatever of this history, because it was not even known in his own day. It was only just being discovered. So there was this sense of a semi-legendary past, the Mycenaean kingdoms, Troy, all of that would have been sometime before 1000 BCE, but quite when, nobody knew. And then the archaeology of the Near East got going. I mean, if you think we go back 3,000 years to 1000 BCE, well, another 3,000 or 4,000 years of history of great civilizations, the great civilizations of Mesopotamia, the Sumerian and Akkadian and early Babylonian civilizations, came into view, and they'd been completely lost. Past time has suddenly opened up in a way that would have been unimaginable, as I say, when my grandfather was at school.
You know, if we could retain the appreciation of the marvel of human existence, we were talking about eyesight before, we would look at the world quite differently and maybe inhabit it more usefully and more humanely. Do we need to get our sense of wonder back day by day on a day-to-day basis?
We do. We definitely do. And, you know, the more you know about the past or about the world, about what's going on in science, the more wondrous it all seems, because it is pretty remarkable. If we're able to put our understanding of research into ancient history, or, you know, sort of pre-classical history, into the context of some of the scientific discoveries which make ground radar and genetics and genetic inquiry into people who lived 10,000 years ago, so that we learn something about the migrations of our human ancestors. Just for one example, the people who built the last iteration of Stonehenge on Salisbury Plain in England had, within a couple of generations of doing so, had completely vanished, and the islands of the British Isles had been occupied by people who had originated on the steppes of Asia, the Yamnaya civilization. Now, that was something that genetics has taught us by comparing the fossil remains of people who lived at the time of Stonehenge before and then later people occupying the British Isles. And this is something that we wouldn't have known without that advance in science. So science is helping with history. History is putting us into richer, deeper context. And it's the connections between these things and the overall framework of view they give us, which I think just makes being alive so exhilarating to know all these things and to have some sense of the bigger picture.
Yes, it is exhilarating. Also scary if populations, I noted that in the book, can change so much, replace other populations. It also gives us, because we labour under a false illusion that somehow accepting nuclear disaster, you know, the world, future world is foreseeable, but gee, it's always changed a lot, hasn't it?
Yes, it has hugely. I mean, there you are in the beautiful, beautiful country of New Zealand, which, by the way, I absolutely love. And think about the population changes there just in the last century or two. Yes. And how that, you know, really does kind of reprise some of the great changes which have happened in the past too.
You have clear interests in the times, you know, the tempora and mores, as well as in the lofty realms of science in this book. It's so big. I mean, we've only looked at about 5% of it. And seeing as the word frontiers is in its title, what prognoses have you for the way the world is going right now, though? It may be unknowable, but you probably think about this.
Well, I'm put in mind, you know, of the remark that prophecy is a mug's game, especially if it's about the future, somebody once said. And, you know, when you think how unexpected, for example, the pandemic is at the moment, a couple of years ago, two, 3 years ago, sort of unimaginable, really. People wouldn't have thought about it. It was just a mere speculation. Yet here it is, having a big impact on the world, on economies. So you see how dramatically and quickly things can change, and because the unexpected happens. So we've got to expect that these challenges will come. But if one were to make some kind of prediction, then it would be this. If we human beings can survive this century, and there are no guarantees, because, you know, we are still, well, you may remember what the philosopher Theodor Adorno said. He said, we humans have got much cleverer over time, but no wiser, as exemplified by the fact that we've developed the spear into the guided missile. Mm-hmm. That's cleverness, but not wisdom. And the problem of surviving this century on the crest of this incredibly rapidly moving wave of increasing knowledge. Think of all the technologies of AI, of being able to interfere genetically with fetuses and so on and so on. A lot of good there, but also some serious dangers. And we're faced with challenges that are happening so fast that we haven't really thought about how to manage them properly yet. But if we can survive this century, then what our descendants are going to be like 100 years from now, 200, 300, 500 years from now, are probably very different from us. And they will look back at us with amazement at how primitive we were in so many respects, from our teeth to our understanding of the world.
We might, and perhaps we think of this in our idle moment, be on the frontiers of enormous things. Does it tempt you, for example, that when your existence winks out, all that knowledge and wisdom and acuity of yours might in a nanosecond be transferred to another realm of existence? There are all manner of possibilities, aren't there, now?
Well, there are, but some are more probable than others, of course. So this is one reason for trying to write down one's views, because they have a better chance of lasting a bit longer than one does oneself. But as you say, you never know. I mean, somebody might come up with something whiz. Personally, I'm hoping that the stem cell chaps will get a real move on, and so we can all live a bit longer and see how things pan out.
Thank you very much, as always, for your valuable time, and lovely to talk to you.
Lovely to talk to you, Jim. Many thanks.
Professor A.C. Grayling.